Why don't we get started? Welcome to all of you. I feel like I have to, you know, kind of shout to reach them to the end of the room. It's nice to have all of you here today with us. And I'm particularly delighted to welcome our featured speaker and our illustrious discussant. Helena Coban received a grant from us in 2002 to write a book that focused on whether the prosecution of high-level human rights abuse of war criminals is a mechanism that helps break the cycle of violence and violent conflict. And as those of you who saw the display copy of her book outside, or those of you who have already purchased the book, and I can say that UFF has no financial stake in the purchase of the book, but there are order forms outside if you are interested. As you know from looking at the book, it focuses on three African case studies, the one in Mozambique and South Africa. Now, UFIT has focused over the last 10, 15 years very heavily on some of these questions that are at the center of this this book. And I think it's fair to say that the bulk of this work has come down, is either leaned heavily toward or come down strongly in favor of the notion that holding war criminals and other human rights violators accountable and promoting historical memory processes such as truth commissions and memorialization efforts are productive and useful things for society to do as they try to move beyond the conflict stage. We have funded some work on the other side of that equation. Some of you may remember our former fellow Rosalind Shaw, who was focusing on West Africa and really came down strongly on the other side of the equation. The basic questions that we're engaging with today include the following. Number one, does accountability, the seeking accountability for war crimes and atrocities, advance the peace-building process and advance reconciliation processes in society? We're finding that question a bit further. What differential impact, if any, is there between the impact of tribunals versus truth commissions as basic tools in the toolkit where you're trying to promote peace building and reconciliation? Number three, how much remembering is healthy? And what effect does the promotion of historical memory of conflict through memorials and truth commissions in verbalized memories, verbalized remembrance, as Helena has described it, what impact does this kind of work have on peace building? Certainly there are many other questions that that are, I think, at the heart of this inquiry, which I think she has spent a little bit less time focusing on the book. But they include, for example, how does the passage of time affect the value and impact of transitional justice intervention? What's the kind of differential impact on individuals versus larger societies within groups that are emerging from conflict? Now, one informant in this book that she quotes says rather pessimistically, quote, the premise that you have to start with is that you cannot repair the damage that has been done. Meaning, I think, that there's no perfect solution. And I think if we all dig down deep enough, we recognize that the kind of harm that's done both to individuals and societies through violent conflict is at some level irreparable, that you can never recover lost ones. The time lost in the lives of survivors can never be redeemed in any, complete way. But then the stepping back from that, the next question is, what are the second best alternatives? And I think that's fundamentally what Holiness is all about. Now, this is a controversial book, I'm happy to say. I like controversy. I think it makes life more interesting. And I have constructed a panel here today to explore some of those controversies. And I assume that we will have differences of opinion on the panel, and I view that as part of an ongoing and healthy debate here at UFIT. We have assembled a stellar panel of discussants, and what people who are into sports like to say, a deep bench at UFIT that we happen to have this year. It just so happens we have three fellows, and we had a fourth who unfortunately is stuck on his way back from Rwanda and would have joined us, Michael Johnson. Gerald Vahima has very kindly stepped in at the last minute. We have three fellows, current residential fellows here at USIP, whose work is focusing in different ways, but on some of these questions, and who all come from very in terms of their own personal and professional experience in engaging with these issues. I will not go into their biographies, nor into the biography of our speaker, because they are provided to you out front. But I'll just say that I think they all speak from the position of extended time in the field and direct personal experience in engaging with these issues. I'm also going to call on Neil Critz early on in the discussion. Professionally involved in these issues here at USIP with us for many years. So with that, I want to open up the session, and I'm going to ask Helena to speak for no more than 15 to 20 minutes, which is always a tall order, and then give each of our discussants about 5, maybe 8 minutes to respond and speak from their own experiences, and then we'll open it up to the floor. So, Helena.
Thank you, Judy. Thank you to the U.S. Institute of Peace, which did contribute to the funding of this project. As PRC said about reconciliation, they did not achieve the whole thing, but they contributed to it. And I'm very grateful. And you have formed this great panel for discussion. I'm a little bit scared. But anyway, I've done the very best that I can with this book. It's a little bit of a personal journey. And looking at what is important in that journey for me, I would have to say that I start with the importance of my experience in the 70s as a young reporter living and working in a society that was racked by civil war for a considerable period of time. A fact that I think gives me a different perspective than many people who have not had that experience of trying to run a household, raise children, and deal with all the stress of living in a society racked by civil war. And of course, Lebanon is a, if you like, a paradigmatic society, example of a society where a degree of social peace has been reached, but none of the traditional transitional justice interventions have been made. And I think there is a correlation between those two facts. I'm a longtime member of Amnesty International, a group that I perhaps should be renamed No Amnesty International, but we can go into that later. I sit on the Middle East Advisory Committee of Human Rights Watch, so I've been very involved with human rights issues, human rights advocacy issues for a long time. And in the early 90s, when the two ad hoc tribunals were formed, I was a big supporter of that, and through the 90s. And it was only towards the end of the 90s, or even perhaps year 2000, when I suddenly decided that this issue needed much deeper examination. And in fact, it was sort of a transformative moment, if you like, on a panel that I was on in Geneva with David Sheffer, the former ambassador for war crimes, when he said, well, things are going pretty well in Rwanda, we've got the ICTR, and we've got national prosecutions, and this and that, and we have, by the way, there are 140,000 people who've been in detention for 5 years, and that is a little bit of a problem. And then I thought, that kind of just came to me as an immense thing to consider if you have a society of 7 million people where you have roughly, 140,000 of them able-bodied people of breadwinning age with many dependents who are removed from productive engagement in the economy and in detention with no possibility, or rather, I know Gerald will tell us later how things have been going in Rwanda, but at that time I think the estimates were that it would take 100 to 200 years to even process all these cases. So, that's the point at which I said let's look at this issue more deeply. My first point of comparison there was between Rwanda and South Africa. Like most people in this country, I was deeply inspired by the whole TRC experience. And in fact, growing up in England in the 1960s, the anti-apartheid movement was the most important issue for me. It was the issue, that brought me into a study of international affairs and engagement in international affairs. So here are my three case studies that are dealt with, one in each in a chapter in the book. Mozambique, which had a conflict. I had to do a lot of work with language in the book, actually, because, I was looking at peacemaking efforts or conflict termination opportunities. I don't think they all worked out. In particular, the one in Rwanda is deeply problematic. But there were turning points there in the period of late 92 to mid 94. In Mozambique, you had the general peace agreement that brought to an end a 15-year civil war that had been marked by just horrendous atrocities, many of which are forgotten in this country and in the Western discourse more generally these days, precisely because the conflict termination attempt was so successful. People don't think of Mozambique as a case study in transitional justice. And in a sense, it was, and in a sense, it wasn't. The sense in which it wasn't is that they, by design and choice, decided not to have war crimes courts, truth commissions, or any systematic memorialization attempt for the civil war at all. If you go to Mozambique and look for memorials, you'll find many memorials to the national liberation struggle, but you won't find any to the civil war, and that is by design. Basically, they had a blanket amnesty that was enacted by the parliament in 1992, and they just left all that stuff behind them. And, you know, that's the short version of what is a very rich and interesting chapter in the book. And you had South Africa, which in April 1994 had the first one person, one vote democratic election. And obviously still a lot of baggage left over from the 400 years of colonialism and the 40 years of apartheid. And a portion of that was addressed in the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which addressed gross human rights abuses described as, you know, acts of visible violence, but did not start to address the resource issues that, you know, obviously have been a massive expropriation of resources, natural resources and land in particular, and, you know, uncompensated labor from the indigenous people and the imported peoples, the indentured imported peoples in South Africa over that period of 400 years. And it's only since 1990, well, since, you know, recent years that you have had the Land Commission that has slowly been starting to address some of those resource issues. But the TRC addressed issues of gross direct physical violence. And then in Rwanda, we had, in the middle of 1994, the RPF came to power and ended the genocide, and then struggled, I would say, to deal with the legacies of the genocide. And you had two things happening in essence in parallel in Rwanda. You had the international community with getting up and running one of those two ad hoc tribunals, the ICTR, which continues its work till this day, which established in November 1994. And then at the national level, you've had successive different attempts. First of all, straightforward prosecutions, and that was the process that led to these, you know, 140,000 people being locked up in just horrendous conditions in detention centers. And some of the descriptions that I have in the book and that I have heard from people, testimonies about the conditions in those detention centers, is just horrendous. And then they moved from that, under Gahima's leadership, in a sense, to introducing the Gacaca court system. A lot of people, including myself, had a lot of hope invested in that. But from my perspective, it doesn't seem to have been terribly successful, but I'm hoping to hear more about it from Gahima later on. But, you know, basically an attempt to use one or another version of the criminal justice system to hold to account individuals on an individual basis. So when I started looking at this in the end of the year 2000, I wanted to sort of take a retrospective, make a retrospective evaluation and see how successful these three different sets of decisions had proven for the countries concerned. And I do have a very strong view that it is the stakeholders, the people in the countries concerned, that we should primarily be concerned with, not, you know, the body, this amorphous body called international criminal law, and, you know, making groundbreaking precedents in this body of international law. Because the people who participate in that and you know, get salaries from it and build institutions from it are, you know, very far removed. In the summer, I had the experience of, you know, first of all, interviewing Luis Moreno Campo in The Hague in his, you know, lovely office in a sort of 13th floor of a beautiful office building in The Hague, and then going to Uganda and sitting with people in an IDP camp, you know, talking about the persecutions, and just the contrast between the living conditions of these people is something that I think we have to bear in mind. And who are the stakeholders? That's one of my big questions. So, my principal findings, which I refined sort of last year before the book went to the press, I summed them up in chapter 5 and then looked at them again in chapter 6. Okay. Has democracy been well institutionalized in each of these three countries? Rwanda, no. South Africa, yes. Mozambique, fairly well. Movement on the Freedom House indicators. And I'm not going to, if you don't know what Freedom House indicators are, ask me afterwards. It's a little bit complex. But basically, 1 is good, 7 is bad. Each country gets 2 numbers. So the best ranking is 1-1, and the worst ranking is 7-7. So in Rwanda, between 1994 and 2006, the movement on the random Freedom House indicators was 0. In South Africa, the movement on the indicators was 6 points between the two indicators. And in Mozambique, the movement on the two indicators was 4 points in a positive direction in each of those cases. So these are things actually, you know, the Freedom House indicators are things that people in the human rights movement traditionally are concerned with. They measure political rights and civil liberties. They are things that we should be concerned with in the human rights movement. And so here you have a sort of, you know, a gross picture of what the movement has been. I look at Human Development Index ratings, but I'm not sure they're actually particularly useful because of the ravages that HIV/AIDS has wrought across the whole of sub-Saharan Africa. I look at size of military forces, which for me is a good indicator of the degree of security in a society and the kind of the resource allocation within a society between military on the one hand and health and human services on the other hand. So in Rwanda, the military sources over this period of 1993 to 2005 ballooned from 5,200 to 51,000. In South Africa, it went down from 67,500 to 55,700. And in Mozambique, it went down from 50,000 to 11,000. So again, another indicator of what's working and what's not working. And then another thing that I did, because I've been trying to do a sort of a cost-benefit analysis. And I know that people who work in international law and, you know, the philosophy of law and all these fine things think that doing a cost-benefit analysis is somehow infradig or, you know, unjustified, and that these are sort of deontological truths that we're dealing with here. You know, people have to be held accountable, et cetera, et cetera. But at the broad social level, I think as a global society, we have to look at costs and benefits. So that's some instance of the costs. Of the benefits, I mean, sorry. Did they get benefits or not from, you know, obviously it's not just the transitional justice policies that they adopted that affected these outcomes, but the transitional justice approaches they adopted made a large contribution to these outcomes. And then the costs. Each case completed at the ICTR, I calculated, cost about $42.3 million. Each amnesty application processed at the TRC cost about $4.3 million. In other words, a disparity of 10,000 to 1 in the cost per case processed. Each case in Rwanda's Gacaca court was projected to cost, and who knows, Berlin, $581. Each former fighter, so in Mozambique, as I said, they had a blanket amnesty, and at the same time, the United Nations had a very robust DDR program. And the people who were involved in this DDR program included all the people who had committed all those atrocities over the previous 15 years. We have to be quite clear-minded about that, apart from the ones who were integrated into the new fighting forces, such as Erminio Moraes, who had been the head of special operations for RENAMO, and in that capacity had probably organized some of the very worst atrocities. Erminio became the chief of training for the new integrated armed forces, and when I met him in Maputo a couple of years ago, he was just finishing his law degree, which I thought was an interesting outcome, and I'd like to hear whether lawyers think that's an interesting outcome or not. So in Mozambique, each former fighter who was DDR'd, it cost the international community about $1,000, and similarly in South Africa, they had a DDR program that was nationally financed, and it cost, for each former fighter who was DDR'd, it cost about $1,000. So, you know, that's the kind of cost per case that I was looking at. So I'll run very quickly through seven big theoretical questions. The first one is the purview of the field of transitional justice. In its early years, this field dealt primarily with post-dictatorship transitions in Latin America and East Europe. And over time, it has come to deal more with post-conflict transitions. South Africa was a transitional mixed case in that regard. And I think there are very different social and infrastructural, if you like, capacity contexts in these two kinds of situations. I mean, you know, in Uganda or Rwanda, you're talking about a country that had a very poor institutional capacity to start with, and then it was just torn apart by conflict. Whereas, you know, in Argentina or Chile or Czechoslovakia, you're talking about a very different institutional capacity. So, you know, in many of these post-conflict situations, physical infrastructure is almost not present. People's most basic economic needs are not being met. You know, this is very different from East Germany or Poland or Chile. Then secondly, you have the clash between the claims of the humanitarian movement, which is concerned with meeting people's most basic economic needs, and the claims of the international human rights movement, which has always focused much more on civil and political rights than on economic and social rights, and this is precisely because it grew up around the Helsinki movement in an East European context where people's economic and social rights were already largely being met, but it was the civil and political rights that people were working on. Thirdly, the main contest in the Western literature up until now has been seen as one between the claims of truth and the claims of justice, but the very necessary claims of peace have been consistently undervalued or ignored. And what I'm trying to do with the book is put the claims of peace back into the discussion. Fourthly, I think we need to be aware of the very real risks of increasing polarization in use of prosecutions and even truth establishment efforts, especially in fragile situations of very recent or still unresolved intergroup conflict. I've been reading a little bit recently, for example, about the fact that the ICTY still has a very polarizing effect in internal Serbian politics and is not necessarily helping the Serbs to do what they need to do. Obviously can be discussed. I don't know enough about Serbia to make a firm judgment on that. But one case that I do know more about is the Saddam trial, where evidently the Saddam trial has done nothing to contribute to national reconciliation inside Iraq, and indeed has been extremely divisive at a time when God knows the Iraqi people don't need more causes for division. My own strong preference is to put the claims of conflict resolving diplomacy ahead of calls for prosecution. For example, even when some of my friends were trying to prosecute Ariel Sharon for his involvement in the 1982 massacres in the southern Shatila camps, I had friends in the Shatila camp. I mean, I worked in the Shatila camp teaching English. It's not that I dishonor them. But I just don't see what it's going to do for Palestinians, either as individuals or as a group, if, you know, Sharon gets successfully prosecuted or not successfully prosecuted. What is important is to resolve the diplomatic problem. And also, just in Mozambique, I note, for example, that one of the issues that held up the holding of the negotiations for a long time was the use of the language of criminalization by Frelimo, which referred to Renamo as bandidos armados. You know, just they are only armed bandits. Why should we, how can we negotiate with them? And of course, now in the present context, the language of the discourse of anti-terrorism is used in the same way. But, you know, often criminalizing language is used to prevent the possibility of negotiations that are very necessary. Fifthly, something that I alluded to before, the who decides these transitional justice issues is very important. In Rwanda, I note that in November 1994, when the ICTR was created, it was created by the Security Council by a vote of 13 to 1. The Rwandan government itself was a member of the Security Council at that time and was the one member there that voted against it. But the other 13 just went straight ahead and you know, bulldozed their way right over the government of Rwanda and said, no, we want to have this ICTR the way we want to have it. And it just strikes me as the cause of a lot of continuing problems that there have been between the ICTR and the government of Rwanda, and very disrespectful of the people of Rwanda. Sixthly, my work has really raised for me huge issues about the nature of justice and accountability. 5 more minutes.
Yes.
I'm very generous.
The nature of justice and accountability. I think both of these have been construed in most of the Western discourse as essentially backward-looking notions. Both of them need to be unpacked and given a much more forward-looking content. In particular, for example, with accountability. In Mozambique, at the time of the General Peace Agreement, people in essence entered a new compact with each other, that we will, you know, hold each other accountable through this new political democratic system. And Renamo became a political party, an opposition party, and by and large played by the rules, participated in the elections, and since 1994 they have had 3 successful nationwide democratic elections. So that's the kind of accountability that I think is important. Rather than trying to seek to establish this highly individualized, backward-looking accountability, who did what to whom on such and such a day in, you know, April 1987, driving a blue sedan, the kind of, you know, details that you just get hung up on endlessly if you go and sit in a courtroom in Arusha dealing with events in Rwanda. So try to give the notion of accountability a forward-looking content. And the same with justice. Justice, you know, is so much construed in the West as being synonymous and coterminous with the orderly working of a criminal court. But if you ask people who are coming out of a conflict-ridden society what kind of justice they want, very often the first thing they will say is, you know, we need food, we need a roof over our head, we need to be able to reconstitute our families and our societies. And the issue of, you know, punishing a wrongdoer, even the idea of what, you know, what wrongdoing is very different in many of those contexts than what it seems when we sit here in a very comfortable situation, let's face it, in a nice conference room in Washington, D.C. Okay, seventh. Actually, I want to put in another one, very quickly. But the other one is the need to be attentive to the role of religions in peace building. I've written quite a bit about that in the book at various points. I've also written an article about it that's available on my website. And just attention to all forms of social healing, which were undertaken a little bit through the TRC, but which were undertaken much more extensively, much more intentionally, and much more successfully in the Mozambique peace-building effort. And it, I think that's been just grossly undervalued in the West, most of the Western discourse. And then finally, the need to see all these processes as political processes that take place over time. I just think when people are coming out of an extremely traumatic period in their history, maybe the very worst time to invite a you know, sustained reflection on the causes of the recent violence and, you know, how do we understand the recent violence, whom should we hold accountable for it. And I note that, for example, Nuremberg is taken as the paradigmatic, the sort of the seminal event in the development of modern criminal, international criminal justice. For most Germans, Nuremberg was absent at the time. I mean, the Allies did what they could to you know, disseminate news about Nuremberg, and but most Germans were just consumed with trying to, you know, literally put food on the table and rebuild their shattered cities and absorb 8 million German refugees who were flooding in from the east. And they didn't have the time or the physical time or the mental energy to deal with Nuremberg and the recent past. It wasn't until about 15 years later that they had, you know, thanks in large part to the Marshall Plan, they had stabilized their society and those immediate basic human needs were no longer burning, that they were able to go back and start asking the questions, well, you know, what did grandfather do in the 1930s? What did Uncle Hans do in the 1940s, and start to interrogate the society. And to expect societies, whether in Sierra Leone or Northern Uganda or anywhere else, to do this immediately after, when the society is still racked by these differences, as is the case, I think, in Rwanda today, I think we're just asking too much, and it's not helpful. Of course, it's good that Nuremberg was able to establish that historical record, but in essence, that wasn't the most important thing. It didn't have to be a court process. I mean, the Allies could just have, you know, taken all the documents and put them in the National Archives in Sweetland, Maryland, and they would have been there, and then you could have had a truth commission or something in the 1960s. But I will stop there because I've taken my time.
Thank you. I think the gauntlet has been thrown down. So now we will turn to our discussion. Daryl, can you go first?
Thank you. 8 minutes is not a long time, so if I make statements that start watching big controversial issues, you will forgive me. First of all, these are very complex questions to which there are no definite answers. So I won't express my opinions about some of the issues that Helen has raised, and I thank her for the work that she's done. We've discussed some of these issues over the years. My personal theory about these issues is as follows. I think that in ideal circumstances, prosecution of perpetrators of accountability should be the norm, and amnesty should be the exception. Like in Rwanda after the war, you know, we had to discuss these issues, and survivors would tell us, you know, just implement the law as it was. They are requesting for what is their rights. They are not asking for a privilege. And although, you know, it's true that survivors of these atrocities have other needs, they also feel very strongly, they assert their right to justice. So it's not as if they don't really want justice, they would rather forget it if they had other issues. They have other concerns, but justice is important to them as well. Two, there are situations where, you know, justice does have positive effects. I would look, for example, at even in Rwanda, the fact that the ICTR has arrested all these people who committed the genocide and arrested them and put them behind bars. These people were living, you know, in refugee camps in the Congo, using aid to sell, to raise money to attack Rwanda. So justice has had that peace and purpose in having them arrested. So justice does have some positive benefits, and it has the potential to lead to stabilizing society. If that's what a large constituency in the country feels, that, you know, these people ought to be punished because of what they did, maybe with justice it could provide a framework for peacefully resolving the conflicts that face that society. Having said that, I agree. I wouldn't say I agree with her. She thinks, if I understand Helen correctly, she would rather we do not have this retributive justice at all. She has other priorities. My take on this is, I would reluctantly consider foregoing prosecutions if the overriding political goals, let's face it, what's the core objective of all these laws? It's to protect the rights of people, the integrity of human life, to prevent suffering. So if we insist that there should be justice at the cost of all this, I think that's not morally right. I recall something that President Chissano said on at least about 2 years ago. You know, he was under pressure to negotiate with Renamo, but at the same time, you know, he wasn't convinced he should talk to them because of the atrocities. But he was moving towards agreeing to negotiations, and he went to a certain community where so many people had been killed, the bodies had been thrown by Renamo into the river until the village had no water to drink because the walls were poisoned. And he had the task of explaining to these villagers that, you know, bad as they are, I need to talk to them because I've tried to defeat them and I failed. And as Helen explained, he took Lagambo, and I really agree that it has paid off for Mozambique. Better than continuing the conflict would have done. So there may be comparing reasons and palatable reasons why it may be better not to have justice than to have trials. Three, I think we need to make distinctions between different circumstances of different countries. I think countries that have experienced mass atrocity, like Rwanda, really have no choice but to make distinctions between perpetrators, to decide how many people can be tried and how many people, you know, should be forgiven. Latest estimates about Gacaca is that it's expected to try more than 700,000, assuming you could even try them. How do you punish them? So, and that's why I think we as leaders of Rwanda have failed. We leaders should be there to lead. I think the government of Rwanda really ought to be open with our society, that we have to make choices about who we should try and who we should deal with in some other form. Because if we do not, we get exposed to situations where, first of all, we abuse the human rights of many people. You know, you can't try so many people fairly. You also open opportunities for governments to give amnesties at the time that suits them for political ends. And I think that, for example, it happened at the beginning of 2003 when we were about to have elections. And that really does offend survivors. So, except I would take exception to what you call broad policies of collective punishment. What has happened in Rwanda is not collective punishment. There's no collective guilt. It's individual guilt. But what you done is indiscriminate prosecutions, and I agree with you that it's not appropriate to prosecute each and every person in situations where there has been mass atrocity. We really have to make choices. Four, assuming women have justice, it's not enough to have justice. We need to find out what kind of justice is it. We need to ask ourselves, has the process of determining these accountability mechanisms been consultative and participatory, or has it been imposed from above by a government to serve its own political goals? Two, do these mechanisms have the support of all the major stakeholders? Do the mechanisms constitute a genuine process of establishing the rule of law, or is it a process of, you know, victor's justice, manipulated for the victor's political advantage? Is that process fair to all the parties? Does it address the grievances of all the victims in a fair manner, without discrimination? Are these processes part and parcel of a process that aims to establish a genuinely democratic order? Do they seek to establish an impartial historical record, or are they a process that aims to legitimize one side and to demonize the losers? And lastly, I mean, for example, how do you treat the victims? What process? How do you deal with all their grievances? You know, the victims are not necessarily represented in the post-conflict order. And those are concerns that ought to be addressed. You may have justice, but it may not serve them. So if it's not for them, for whom is it? So my conclusion is, I think justice is important, but I think its importance is sometimes overrated in these situations. I would not agree with Helen where she says that Rwanda's accountability process is whether by the national courts or the ICTR, that they have had a strong impact in keeping the Tutsi Hutu privilege alive and wide. But I agree to this, they definitely not help to resolve it. And why not? I think, in my opinion, I think justice should not be an end in itself. Justice does not serve its wider goals in a political vacuum. It's only useful in an environment that seeks to deal with the root causes of conflict. If you have accountability mechanisms, but you have political exclusion, rather, there's no political participation, it's a system that still manifests exclusion. Justice that occurs in an environment where repression is still existing. Issues that you talk about in the book, as I agree with the assessment about the situation in Rwanda. If anything, I think you're a bit mild. I think then, you know, just we cannot say that justice has been in vain, but it definitely does not help to make this country a peaceful, stable society that the justice process was intended to be. Lastly, in the book, towards the end, page 241, you write about, I think, some 8 conclusions about post-conflict societies should deal with their reconstruction process. I agree with all of them, except that I don't agree with the low priority that you give to justice and accountability. I think justice and accountability really does have a role to play in these situations. in particular, I think leaders, those who bear the greatest responsibility, they should always be tried. Because if you don't try them, you can never have democracy and the rule of law. I think one of the problems for Rwanda is that you have a government under the control of war criminals. They will never allow democracy until, if they are to be held to be accountable. So I think that there should be justice, especially for people who bear the greatest responsibility. I believe that in certain situations, it's really important that we should even have international criminal institutions, because domestic courts, which these people control, cannot try them. And this is not just about Rwanda, it's also about other countries. With regard to those who are not at the top, I think how we deal with these issues depend on the political circumstances. Again, I believe that justice should be the norm and unless should be the exception. Given the right circumstances, I would gladly address an amnesty. Thank you.
Thank you. Very interesting. We'll turn now to Joyce Mills.
Yes, thank you. And I want to first congratulate Helena Coban on this book. For those of us who are fellows and who know the pressure of trying to produce a book in 10 months, we can really appreciate the work that has gone into this and the research that has gone into it. I also want to say that I think the style of the book is a little different than some of the writings that you'll find on this topic, and I think that reflects your journalistic background, which makes it, I think, very accessible and also very compelling, because there are many anecdotes and stories of survivors in here that I think illustrate very clearly the challenges that are facing us in trying to secure some form of justice for the survivors' atrocities. And I think reflects the very complicated circumstances under which we're working in many of these different countries. And I think a point that Gerald made, which I think is very important, which is the idea that I don't think we're going to come up with a one model or any kind of specific instruments that are going to be applicable in every situation in which we find ourselves in a post-atrocity setting. The book asks what kind of justice serves to prevent recurrences and to facilitate healing. And just to kind of go through what some of the book mentioned, some of the points that the book mentions on the aims of restorative justice include the idea of gaining communal acknowledgement of the crimes that have been committed, overcoming denial, building a historical record of what happened so that the survivors know what's happened to their families and loved ones. Also, this helps to prevent future denial. Providing an opportunity for mass participation, again, this notion of inclusion, ensuring accountability, and promoting healing and reconciliation. So these are some of the aims in looking at restorative rather than retributive justice. And I think the cases that she has chosen are interesting in illustrating to some extent how these don't seem to be attainable in whole. And so that while one thing may be possible, it doesn't seem as if attaining all of these at any given point is actually feasible. So in light of that, what I want to do in my brief few minutes is to look at just a few of the conclusions of the book in light of the new International Criminal Court, because this book focuses on three cases that took place before we had this new international instrument. And because Helena has said that her bias here is on really a focus more on the peace, stability, social healing side than it is on the justice side, now that we have this rather powerful instrument for dealing with international criminal acts, how is this going to jive with some of the conclusions she's made. First of all, one of the conclusions has to do with amnesties. And as demonstrated in the South African and Mozambique examples, she argues that amnesty can provide for transition from conflict to peace, and that they do not necessarily create a climate of impunity. And in this context, she cites the Freedom House ratings that she just mentioned to us, where basically it shows great improvements in South Africa and Mozambique, and basically none in Rwanda, which is ranked as not free. Amnesty is an interesting dilemma for the new International Criminal Court. Are amnesties respected? Are they not respected? In the case of Mozambique, it was a blanket amnesty. And so this is really a challenge, because can national amnesties continue to be offered to perpetrators of atrocities given the International Criminal Court or the ICC? And will those who have been given amnesty nationally still be subject to prosecution by the ICC? And the question is basically, is the ICC going to pursue justice at the expense of peace? And I come from the peace side of things and the peacemaking side of things, and I think that it's really critical to be able to have some of these bargaining chips, so to speak, in order to, as Gerald noted, really prevent continued suffering. And the question is, if leaders who've been waging war know that at the end of peace agreements or peace talks, they're going to be subjected to life imprisonment, are they going to come to the table? And the cases of Haiti and South Africa, Bosnia, Liberia, actually show that having either exile or amnesty as a bargaining chip to get human rights abusers to agree to some kind of peace agreement and to yield power is really critical. In terms of what the ICC is going to do, it's not quite clear. However, according to some of the more recent writings by in international criminal law literature, it looks like the ICC, in fact, can honor amnesties. Whether they will honor a blanket amnesty seems highly dubious. But individual amnesties, in fact, may be honored. The Rome Statute was left purposely ambiguous with regard to this question, and so it would be up to the prosecutor on a case-by-case basis to determine whether amnesty will be respected or not. If you are interested in this issue, I commend an article by Michael Sharp, which I think came out in 2005, and it looks at basically six questions the ICC should be looking at in order to determine whether an amnesty, whether the ICC should defer to an amnesty that has been granted. The second conclusion in the book has to do with the duty to prosecute, and the idea that there is an insistence on prosecuting, and that this insistence on prosecution can, in fact, perpetuate divisions between the perpetrators and the survivors, who will have to live together at the conclusion of the trials, and that the pursuit of justice, therefore, impedes the restoration of peace. She suggests that nations will heal more effectively after atrocities by focusing on the expressions of remorse by perpetrators and reparations to survivors, rather than by focusing on simply the truth-telling and the allocation of punishment. And she gives the examples of Mozambique and South Africa in this, in talking about, again, as Gerald was saying, the importance of the inclusion, mass participation, the fact that the stakeholders had a voice in the kind of justice that would be pursued, whereas in Rwanda there was no such choice, and in fact that Rwandans were completely excluded from the ICTR, the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, from that entire process. Whereas in the case of Mozambique and South Africa, she mentions that there was much more inclusion. I'm not sure to what extent, in fact, people at the grassroots level and either of those societies would have felt tremendously included in the actual peace process that led to the blanket amnesty in Mozambique. But perhaps were appreciative of that at the time, or for now. And one of the questions is, as Judy raised, was for how long is this transitional period? And I think that's something we really don't know. We don't know to what extent people are now happy at forgetting, so to speak, until they're going to remember and want documentation and want truth-telling and want some form of accountability. In terms of the duty to prosecute with respect to the International Criminal Court, the Rome Statute does have a principle of complementarity, which says that it will defer to a national court if that country is willing and able to prosecute the perpetrators. If they are not, then it can be referred to the ICC. But the cases of Mozambique and South Africa may, in fact, present challenges. Such cases as those cases may present challenges to the ICC and its need to prosecute. But again, as everyone is trying to figure out how the ICC is really going to work, and unfortunately right now we have test cases in front of us that are somewhat suffering, especially the case of Uganda, which my colleague Betty Dombey will talk about a bit more. I mean, some of these cases are and the people involved, I think, are really suffering the birth pains or the birth pains of the ICC. And so we really don't know to what extent the ICC is going to coexist with truth commissions. However, there is a suggestion that there's no reason why an ICC could not coexist with a truth commission, and that at the international level it is possible to refrain from prosecution by invoking Article 53 of the Rome Statute, which is in the interest of justice. And that the Truth Commission could, in fact, take precedence at that point. But again, all of this is still being very much worked out. The third point is appears to be a very strong preference for local mechanisms for justice and healing in the book. And she cites ceremonial rituals in Mozambique that have been critically important to reestablishing social cohesion and coexistence. And Helena cites a woman in Mozambique saying, "For now, the past is too much of the present for us to examine its details. For now, we prefer silence over confrontation. While we cannot forget, we would like to pretend that we can." So again, the question of timing comes up in transition. Will this woman feel the same way? She says twice in this quote, "For now, for now." I think this is the issue confronting Uganda. It's the issue confronting many. For now, the priority is peace. But for those of you who know the article by John Paul Lederach on truth, justice, mercy, and peace, all four of them are critical components to a sustainable peace. And so if we elevate mercy to a point where we're not going to have justice, and justice here I am not construing as prosecutorial justice necessarily, then perhaps down the road we haven't done right by the victims, by the survivors, if we do not have any form of justice and or truth that comes out at this. And as we see with the local systems of the Gacaca in Rwanda and Mato Oput in Uganda, indigenous systems have not been designed to deal with mass atrocities. I think we in the West have a tendency to romanticize the capacity of people in horrific situations to forgive, I think mistaking the desire to get on with their lives for forgiveness. And I'm not sure the two can be equated. So the fact that you want and that you need food and shelter and you want to move on I think, is not the same thing as saying that you forgive and are reconciled. And so I think we need to be careful not to romanticize the capacity of indigenous mechanisms to handle this. Finally, and then on the ICC again, the ICC does not exclude the use of indigenous mechanisms, but it reserves the right to try those who are viewed as the most culpable. But the ICC will never prosecute many people. Finally, with respect to the book, it's an ambitious book, and it's grappling with a very difficult issue, as you can see here. I think that one of the dilemmas, again, is on who, on the perception of the stakeholders, and much to Helena Coman's credit, she's gone back to talk to them on several occasions. I think we still need to track them down the road to see, you know, what is justice, what do we know about justice, and how it's done. Finally, Declan Roche noted in an article published last year, post-conflict societies face a difficult challenge in deciding how to deal with the past in a way that does not jeopardize the future. Peace is fragile, resources are limited, and steps taken to pursue one laudable goal may hinder the accomplishment of another. So I want to again congratulate Helena Coban for her efforts to clear a path for better understanding of this complicated issue.
Thank you. I would also like to congratulate you very, very much for having taken on this very pertinent topic. There's not a single day in my life, in the last 2 years or so, that this question of justice and peace has not, in one way or another, been as confronted or have had to think about it because of what is going on in Uganda. So I think you are... You're very brave to have taken this on. I must confess, I'm really not very confident discussing on this. I did not thoroughly read the book. I must appreciate my research assistant who did an outline for me so that I could pick and choose which chapter to read and which one not to read. So I must confess I'm not very confident in discussing this. I also appreciate the fact that you said it's somewhat both from Gerald and Joyce that there's no single model that you can replicate. You say that, but in the same way, and I'm going to be brief and use the expression that in the same way you are saying that in your conclusion, the international consensus that human rights violations must be punished may not necessarily be the right thing. So to me, it is, you're almost saying that one size fits all. Well, I find that the situation is very, very complex, and you cannot come up with a very strong recommendation as to what should be done. And I would use this word Joyce has used, romanticizing about the ideas of Maputo and the Chacha without really looking into the details. Interestingly, you talk about who should make the decision. Is it the international community, or should it be the respective governments? But whereas you demonstrate in very clear terms the feeling of the victims, you do not include, although you visited Uganda, you visited Mozambique, that ultimately, and this is my opinion, they are the people that should make decisions as to what should be done. I'll tell you why I am saying that. First of all, I was challenged as a government minister some time back. A victim came to me and said, I see you every day with former rebels. You've gone up, looked for cartridges to give them. You've provided them with this. Here I am a victim with 3 sons killed and husband killed in the most brutal manner, and you're totally ignoring me. And at that point, I called up an attorney at law, and I said, how did we deal? Because here was an amnesty that had been given by government. So in the desire for bringing peace and trying to implement the amnesty, I totally ignore the victims, and I'm dealing only with the rebels. These are my major concerns. So the lawyer actually told me, said, look, the amnesty is granted by government, but as an individual victim, she has every right to go to court of law and sue these people, especially if she has concrete evidence of what happened to her. So here what I'm trying to suggest is that we have not paid enough attention to victims to be able to speak out. And it is very interesting, in your first chapter, you're talking about Agnes being picked up from Rwanda, put on the plane in this courtroom, which is very solemn, with all those judges sitting there, and how she feels seen. What is his name? The culprit in the dock. She, first of all, she feels, obviously, she definitely needs that justice, because she's saying, I wish this was happening in Kiwi, in the actual village where it happened. Where, you know, he conducted all this massacre. Secondly, he's making gestures which reminds her, which is tormenting her of what she went through. And she wishes the judges would understand what she was going through, the pain that he or she is even being further humiliated and hurt by the culprit. Furthermore, these lawyers come up with ridiculous questions, which are this is typical of lawyers. Ridiculous. Not jurors. Defense lawyers. Kind of ridiculing you, confusing you, so that you cannot, you know, you eventually start feeling stupid, because you cannot really project the actual image of what has happened. So to me, it's very, very clear that this victim wants justice. This is not somebody you would say is that she wanted, you know, let's forget, it has happened, I'm ready to move on with my life. It's very, very clear that it is just the setting which is wrong. It is the environment appears to be hostile. She's not familiar with it. But ultimately, she wants justice. I could talk on and on about other cases in Uganda, including child mothers. We now have children who are products of rape. Do these children go back to those pop bush husbands? Do you want them to have a relationship with them or not? And some of them literally throw up when they meet such so-called husbands. So are these people who do not want justice? They do want justice. My, I've said this again at some forum, but I'll repeat it, is that the question is of sequencing. Mm-hmm. If you have a situation in Uganda which is different from Mozambique, and we need to understand more about Mozambique, given what Joyce has just quoted in the books, that she said for now, are we sure that at some point down the road, that this person, if not she, she'll ask her son to go and revenge, take law in their own hands. Because there's been that amnesty by government, but they're not dealing with her feelings, although the traditional practices are there. So the case of ICC in Uganda is that it is not because people rejected it. It is because people are craving for peace. Mm-hmm. They're saying, can we have peace first, and you deal with that later. It is a question of timing, and not only that, the other thing too, people were very disillusioned when they realized that ICC does not have its own army or forces to arrest or kill the rebels. But ICC should also be given credit. The reason LRA is taking these talks for the first time very seriously is because of the arrest warrants. if the arrest warrants, as some people are advocating now, should be dropped in the interest of peace, I have no doubt in my mind that NRA would be very happy to regroup and do something completely different. There must be justice, but we cannot apply, it must not be one size fits all situation. We must understand the socio-economic situation of the country, the political climate in the country, the circumstances. In fact, the Ugandan situation is even more complicated because victims became perpetrators. How do you punish those who one day felt the victims, their lives were threatened, and then the only way to keep alive is to become violent and broken against innocent civilians. It is true too, as you put it, that the priority is to reconstitute their own lives. But again, I go back to what I said earlier on. Yes, for now I want food, I want shelter, I want to have some basic distance, ability to live in a distant manner and have my basic rights restored. But they're not going to say, as I spent quite a bit of time in August and part of September in the camp, basically to talk to victims and hear what they all say. And I walked away really clear in my mind that what they want is easy access. Okay. But of course you have those who do not feel the brutality of the war, who will go and say, no, we are ready to forgive them. In any case, it's not even going to bring lives back. But when you talk to that woman in particular, who just wants to know, were they ever buried, were the bodies of her children ever buried? She wants to see these people in the dark. It's not that part. But she first wants to have a home, assured of her own security. Finally, just a little bit on what Joyce has already talked about, but just as a matter of emphasis, and I will use the expressions she's used on romanticization about the customary practices of justice. In the case of Uganda, the traditional leaders have never had to deal with a problem of this magnitude. You also have a situation where a child is abducted, he or she came back, killed members of the family or members of the community. Whereas in the system, the traditional, customary way, it is one clan against the other, and you have it resolved. So in this case, who is going to sit with the families and resolve the problem? Secondly, it's only on murder cases. It doesn't deal with rape, abductions, mutilations, amputation of limbs. It does not. So how you have people, I was looking at one magazine, I think on BBC, where a young man is saying, I will never ever forget this, because when I look at myself, what I am today now, that I can't even get a wife anymore, I can't live a normal life anymore. And he's living with that every day. Are you going to say the international community is wrong, or the government is wrong, to say, no, we need justice, something has to do something to make this victim go on with their own life? So the traditional justice does not, the traditional customary law does not deal with that. And it is also very much the male thing that women are, they're invited as part of the audience to sit, watch what's going on. But they're not going to speak. There's no, it doesn't give you a forum to vomit out, vent out your anger. If you want to say something, to scream out that, you know, this is what he did to me or to us. So it still has to be that before it can function in a manner that people can accept it. We also have generations that do not know it. I'm in my 50s, I don't know it. And it is the younger generation that has been affected most. Furthermore, the very people who are supposed to help explain America, the traditional leaders who have over the years the respect that they had before, that they trained people, taught people on cultural values, have been ripped off of that dignity because they're living in camps. The poor, they have no homes. How are they going to be listened to and respected to be able to carry out this practice? But ultimately, too, we're all victims. And I still know that there are, we know some of the we know the family of where the culprit came and killed members of my family. We don't talk to them after now. We don't see eye to eye. We're waiting, and I know my other relatives are waiting for peace to prevail. And then we will take some action. We don't want that. Unless you have some form of justice that can convince and satisfy everything. Thank you.
Thank you. This panel is also what Hedo is pointing my name finally they all was. Very welcome. I feel that before opening it up and actually I want to turn to you all to the team up to the couple comments, I should turn back to you, Helena, and would you like to make some
maybe at the end.
At the end. Okay. I'm going to ask Neil if he has any comments, and I want to open it up to the wider audience.
Congratulations, and it's really good book on the book, as well as on what the whole panel is. It's really a fascinating discussion.
And maybe I should say, everyone should introduce themselves. Neil Crick is kind of our little welcome here at USIP.
I guess it's a couple of projections, right? One, that I think one of the lessons of this book of transitional justice increasingly over the years is that neither extreme is generally the solution. In every case, we're talking about complex situations, mass atrocities, complex societal problems that either preceded or at a minimum were created by these atrocities, and simple solutions are almost never going to work. And there is no cookie cutter, as everyone has said. That said, just in terms of the argument, in terms of punitive justice and the use of prostitutions versus the industry in defense of the society. It seems to me that there are some pieces that can't be overlooked in this regard, including, for example, the relation between prosecution, or at least the term of prosecution, versus vigilante justice, versus the sense that, okay, you don't have to take the law into your own hands if you want to actually see perpetrators on the capital. The state is actually going to assume this role. And if not deterrence, because we certainly don't have good proof with respect to deterrence, at a minimum giving people a sense of that the page has been turned, that there is some notion of accountability, human rights protection, that notion of people exist. On the issue of who signs and victims, 2 points. One is that, at least in my experience, feelings are very raw and are fairly easy to manipulate on these issues, country after country. Absolutely, we have to punish everybody, or no, we need compensation, or no, we'd have to have just these. It's understandable. People are hurting, people are in desperate need for many things, and also often divided. You can't get into a mode of saying, okay, victims want X. Victims are almost always divided. Sierra Leone, the victims on different sides were split between some people saying we have to have the tribunal, and others saying no, we have to have the truth commission, we shouldn't have the tribunal. So that's going to be routine. But it is routine that you at minimum have large numbers of victims that, you know, country after country that I've seen, who demand justice, who say that is so important, and they can't be completely ignored. In Bosnia, 11 years after the fact, you talk to most of the victims groups, or many of the victims groups, now some of them are manipulated by various political forces and factions. But the fact is, they say, no, we don't want to talk about reconciliation, we need justice. The South African case can't be overlooked by either, because I think that you can demonstrate very clearly that the only reason why every country to try to get perpetrators to come forward, the only reason why 70,000 came the South African military prosecution. And to some extent, you can even track the rate of applications for the amnesty process against how successful or unsuccessful the prosecutions that were going on would seem to be. And without that, I think everyone agrees. In fact, many of the South Africans will argue today that it can't be replicated, because the fact is that after it was all over, all those threatened prosecutions haven't happened, the government decided it didn't want to go down that road. And so people feel cheated in a sense. Perpetrators who came forward feel like if, you know, they were responsible for doing so, they didn't need to expose it. And other countries say, you know, okay, well, that model isn't really worth that effectively. In places like Chile, I mean, yes, it is a force of over time that, you know, the extent that a country is able to go further and further in terms of establishing accountability to get to the point of actually starting to prosecute people, it took years. But I think for many Chileans, they felt that that was a statement that their democracy was strong, that their country is more stable, that they were able to actually start to go after Pinochet and things like that. But if you're going to say that there's going to be a process over time, then you have to allow society to preserve the options. Simply say we're not going to deal with this allows perpetrators to erase the evidence, allows people to make it impossible to actually deal with this after time. Related to that, I guess the case that always gets turned back to me is the case of the Osmanlis. After World War II, they didn't deal with this in Yugoslavia, and as a result, in that concentration camp, the Rwanda Declaration of Stasi, the Croats argue, you know, all these years later, decades later, the 20,000 people died of typhus, and Serbs firmly believe to this day that many Serbs were slaughtered by the Croatian Ustasha in that same camp. Because mythologies don't disappear, they just grow wider and wider apart. And they provide seeds for new rounds of violence, which is exactly what happened in that case. On your point on Saddam, I think, yeah, I have another question back. It's fine to say what the files didn't work, but what would you propose doing if you said he was a monster who was responsible for the torture and death of huge numbers of citizens? He was captured. Presumably, you wouldn't say, let's just kill him. Presumably, you wouldn't say, let's just throw him in a cell and throw away the key. And then you have to face the question of what you do with those leaders at that point. The other cases, by the way, I mean, I think Sierra Leone also provides a potential counter case. There was an amnesty. And what happened, the RUF actually then went right back to Bruno Lomi. And that's what resulted in the Security Council and others coming back and saying, okay, now maybe we really need to have justice and accountability to stop the violence. The last point is this notion, I mean, I think that there has been progress. It's still a messy feeling, but there is growing recognition of the importance of local ownership, as has been mentioned, and using today. I think we probably have reached the point that talking about models like the ICTY and the ICTR are somewhat passe or obsolete. Because I think there's a recognition that they cost, as you point out, very significantly. They cost an absurd amount of money to accomplish relatively little without having an impact, a transformational impact in a society on the ground. But that's different from the shift to the ICC, because those two tribunals have primary jurisdiction. If Bosnia or Croatia or Rwanda wanted to do something, they weren't allowed to unless those international bodies committed them and said, okay, we'll see if it's too late. And in the case of the ICC, it's the exact reverse. The society's going to take it on itself, and the international body is prohibited from actually taking on the case. And I don't think there's growing recognition that hybrids or things that actually work on the ground with international communities taking a local society engage and build a culture of accountability. We're going to take other ways to go through these problems.
Would you like to
Well, sure. I'll take it very, very quickly. A point that Joyce made about my arguments about remorse. This is something that I'm working on quite a little bit more. With a lot of the survivors of violence that I talked to, I tried to probe exactly what they sought out of whatever process was being proposed. And to have the person who had harmed them express remorse was a very high value. To black South Africans, to Rwandans and to many others whom I talk to. And so I kind of actually developed this whole a sort of a different arc of reconciliation from the one that happens in a criminal court. In a criminal court, you have an accusation and then a trial and then hopefully some penitence and then a punishment. But often what happens in informal processes at work is you have a reproach followed by an expression of remorse and then reconciliation. And I was also very moved by Phumla Gobodo Madikizela's book on the South African torturers there, and how what these women who confronted him really wanted was remorse. And so that is something that I think we need to do a lot more work around. Joyce is quite right to have pointed out the importance of the ICC, you know, and its new kind of, I see a sort of dead hand of Western liberalism put over all these processes that are much more complex and that don't allow the development and support of local processes, and does try to impose a one-size-fits-all. And it's a problem, it's a real problem for the ICC and for Uganda right now, because Luis has six arrest warrants, six cases proceeding against individuals. Five of them are against the leaders of the LRA, one of whom has probably died. Okay, so a large proportion of his original caseload at this point has to do with Uganda, which is completely stalled because of the peacemaking there, thank God, you know. So for him to justify his budgets, it's getting harder and harder, you know, just as a sort of institutional imperative there. But, you know, we were well-meaning when we advocated for the ICC's creation, but we didn't think it through hard enough, I think. On the question of sequencing, yes, absolutely, sequencing is very important. And, you know, I mentioned this whole idea in Germany in the post-Nuremberg era that the Germans weren't ready and then they were ready. And, you know, there's also been sequencing in the kind of feelings broadly described of the Jewish survivors and the Roma survivors of the Holocaust. That for a long time many Jewish survivors did not want to think about the Holocaust, and it's only been in relatively recent times, let's say in the last 20 years, that they have, you know, wanted to come out and say, look, we really want to have our stories told and heard. And the Roma still are not ready, because the Roma are still feeling in Europe, and well, mainly in Europe, which is where they are, extremely vulnerable. They don't have the kind of, you know, the social and psychological ease to be able to say, look, you know, we care about this too. And Isabel Fonseca, in her book about the Roma, has this searing interview with a guy who says, let's not even talk about what happened to us during the Holocaust because it might give them ideas. You know, they feel that it could happen again. It's sort of kind of on a small level is happening again for them. So, you know, people, communities, it's not that like all the Roma are in the same place or all the Jews are in the same place, but there is a sort of an evolution over time in what the victims, survivors want. Coming back to this term victims, I've been very much influenced by this book, Beyond Retribution, by Rama Mani. Rama has done a lot of wonderful work on Seeking Justice in the Shadows of War, is her subtitle. I can't describe the whole book. She worked for the UN for a long time and then did a doctorate on this topic. This is basically her doctoral dissertation, either at Bradford or at Cambridge, and it's very well done because it analyzes her own experience as a UN official in the field of peace building. And one of her strong recommendations is that we do away with this dichotomy between victims and perpetrators. That all perpetrators are also, in a sense, victims, and that's what made them into perpetrators. They're not, like, born evil. But they are people who've gone through traumatic things and from that background have become perpetrators. And that victims are not all innocent. And, you know, Primo Levi also made this argument very persuasively in his Drowned and Saved and in many of his writings. So, you know, to make this dichotomy, it kind of ignores something that's really important in Rama Mani's view and in my view, which is that all these people, all of them, are survivors of violence. I guess Martha Minow said we should call them all victims of violence, but I prefer to call them survivors because that speaks to the strength of their, you know, survival instinct and their capacities rather than their needs. And then you have, you know, survivors across the spectrum, people who have done really horrendous things, and, you know, we need to discuss that. But they also have needs, and they have families who have needs, and if you put every accused survivor into a detention camp, as happened in Rwanda, then the families are, you know, definitely being victimized. So I just think that's a very helpful move that she made. I want to say that I don't argue for amnesty in all cases. That's why there's a question mark in the title of the book, which I insisted on putting in, and my publisher said, no, it's really a lousy way to put a book title, you know, it's going to be very confusing. So now when I mention the book, I have to say, Amnesty After Atrocity, question mark. A little confusing. About the resilience of customary law and the use of customary law, in Mozambique, I found, and my work is highly derivative there, but I was able to talk with some traditional healers who are both male and female there, curanderos and curanderas, and they have a little association. It's quite charming, actually. You go into the heart of this really horrible refugee, IDP, you know, whatever, resettlement camp on the outskirts of Maputo, and there's their little headquarters, and they have a little uniform, sort of a government organization, the AMETRAMO, the Association of the Mozambican Association of Traditional Healers, and women and men, and they sit around and they discuss, you know, what they do. And Carolyn Nordstrom and Alcinda Honwana and others who know the field a lot better than I do show that throughout that 15 years of civil war, the traditional healers were a major resource that helped people to survive the ongoing waves of violence during the civil war. And they, you know, were extremely inventive in developing new rituals, for example, for women who had been taken as sex slaves. And, you know, once the women are freed and come back with or without children from that sex slavery, come back to their fathers, they can't be married, they can't, you know, go through the traditional, you know, they're impure, they're a burden on their families. I mean, their situation is terrible. But the curanderos developed all these rituals to purify these women so that they could be accepted back into the society. And, you know, I think the creativity of the traditional healers in Mozambique is one of the main things that comes out of Carolyn's book and Alcinda's work as well. In a sense, Mozambique was lucky that it never suffered the intense cultural genocide that a lot of other portions of Mozambique suffered under the impact of Western settler colonialism. I mean, the Portuguese more or less sort of left a lot of people alone in Mozambique, so the cultural traditions were more intact than they are, for example, amongst the Acholi people and others in Uganda. So, you know, it's not that all customary healing traditions are sexist and that they are incapable of dealing with new kinds of issues. I think in some circumstances they are capable of dealing with new issues. I guess I'll leave it there for now. For now.
Let's open it up. The audience has been very patient and waiting for a chance to discuss these issues. And if you're interested in asking a question or making a point, raise your hand and I'll start taking down notes. Please give your name and your affiliation.
I'm Patrick Fonzo. I'm Betty's resource assistant. To sort of challenge Betty, too, and to raise a question. In cases like Uganda, where blanket amnesty seems to be the ultimate bargaining chip to create peace, how can that mesh with sequencing? I mean, it appears to me it's either amnesty or no peace, and where does sequencing come from?
Are you asking this of Helena?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
I think I would just describe what would happen later on down the track a little differently. I mean, there are the traditional ceremonies that I guess that's what Norbert Mao and others are arguing for, the empowerment of the traditional ceremonies and their incorporation into international legislation. And then there's the possibility of truth commissions in the future, which is another mechanism of accountability. So, what would happen in the future wouldn't necessarily be a criminal trial.
yes, Amnesty has already ruled that out, but that you could have other things that would be accountability and or, you know, social healing mechanisms that would happen down the pipe.
We need to clarify that. Amnesty was passed by Act of Parliament, Uganda Parliament. And the whole idea at that time was, this was, first of all, it was when I was there, and then it expired. Then 1998, it was reinstated, passed again by Act of Parliament. But the whole idea was to encourage those whose hands were not yet bloody, or who were victims, who became perpetrators, to come out and be given amnesty. So, and it was well received by people because it had some good results, especially in 2004. So many LRAs come out, take advantage of that, with a fully-fledged commission that would give out some packages as a form of incentives for them to start living on. So, but here, so very, very clearly spelled out, in fact, as we speak today, the amnesty law has not been amended, because what is waiting was that the amnesty had only been given to victims who became perpetrators, but not the top commanders of the rebels. So amendment was in process to tally with the ICC indictment that there were those who argued that give it blanket amnesty. But government was saying, no, we cannot give blanket amnesty. It will only be for a group of people, but not the hardcore criminals. So when we're talking about sequencing, we're not talking about the government amnesty. We're talking about justice in a broader sense.
Carrie Sponsky with the Global Youth Partnership for Africa. With the examples of Sierra Leone and Rwanda in mind, where there was very significant local opposition to the establishment of international criminal courts, I'm wondering to what degree members of the panel believe that these sort of formal institutional reconciliation processes serve in a way to assuage a sense of guilt on the part of the international community rather than address the very real grievances of the victims or the survivors of armed conflict.
Anybody want to take a stab at that?
I'll say largely, yes.
Gerald?
Well, no doubt that the guilt of the West had a lot to do with the failures of 1994. But we can take it even further. The guilt that kept the West from doing something about 94 continues to affect these societies, because people who are not able to do anything in 1994 have lost the moral authority to comment about human rights issues in these countries after 1994. That's it. We did not do anything to stop the genocide. Rwanda has made great use of the guilt of the West. Silence, criticism about its human rights record, its record on democratization, and it's something that could have a big impact. It's not just about 94, but it continues to have an impact today.
Jay is next. I have a couple of questions. Thank you for the presentation to everyone. I wonder if, going back to the comment that Tom made about the differentiation or getting rid of the distinction between victims and perpetrators, I wonder if the other panelists might care to comment on that, that way of conceptualizing the issues. Also, I wonder if Tom, you might talk about how the existence of the ICC impacts your findings, if at all, because you made very provocative comment that things have changed since your case study. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if you might project ahead how you might revise your findings in light of the existence of the ICC. And the third question
question is just a question of curiosity. How did you choose the pieces that you chose? And why did you choose these over others? And how did that selection kind of shape the findings that you came up with?
Good question.
Well, in a sense, I wrote the book because I saw the identity coming and imposing its sort of its cookie cutter, one size fits all approach to what needs to happen. And I was, I wanted to warn against that, and I wanted to retrieve the example of Mozambique, because Mozambique and South Africa and the TRC are what would not be allowed if the TRC, if the ICC had existed back at that time. You could not have, in the present period, now that we have the ICC, member states engaging in what Mozambique and South Africa did in 1992 and 1994. And that, I wanted to warn against that, warn about that. And how I chose the cases, okay, most of my work has been on the Middle East. And I really wanted to get away from the Middle East. Because it was driving me crazy, you know. You work on it for 25 years and like everything looks really bad. So that was one huge reason. And I had the idea that if I go and work, you know, like I said, South Africa has been in my blood since I was a teenager. I mean, it's the reason I got involved in global issues at all. So I wanted to work on that, and this seemed like it just evolved as a really compelling project for me. I chose the cases because those conflict termination attempts all happen in roughly the same period, and so we had the same kind of 10 to 12 years of post-conflict to look back at. You know, it looked like a doable project. And then I hoped, and I still hope, that some of these lessons will be of relevance in a post-conflict era between Israelis and Palestinians, or in Iraq, or in other areas of the Middle East. You know, one day I can take some of this expertise back to the Middle East and say, look.
Okay, yes,
right here. Yeah, I'm Dan from Refugees International. I've got a question for you, Ms. Coleman. We have heard that people should make a decision about how to go in terms of trying to address the violations and abuses. Well, I think you had the case of Angola, for instance. It's not the two cases that you have dealt with. But it seems to me that, first of all, the victims or survivors, who we can call it how we want, they, in conditions, may not be able to take a proper decision. And this is what for instance, the survivors or victims told me, say, we are sick of the violence, we don't want to think about this, so let's move on, let's secure peace. This preamble to say, what has been in your experience, what have you seen in your experience, in terms of international support to victims or survivors after the peace process is completed, in terms of helping them to either heal or helping them in secure the truth? Because we know the war in Angola finished 2002, violence went from 75 to 2002. There's no talk about discussing the previous violences and bringing people to justice. What has been international support to this kind of effort? Because it seems that the international or Western tendency is to go along the justice line or persecution, and there is money and there is interest on that. It seems that after peace is reached, everybody goes and there's not much left for victims.
Yeah, in Mozambique, you did have throughout the 90s very strong Western involvement in the whole kind of post-conflict rebuilding effort. I mentioned the DDR, which of course affected not only the former combatants but also their families. It wasn't perfect; in fact, it was highly imperfect. But it did succeed in really demilitarizing the society in a very successful way. And there were other, both UN and international NGO projects to help, the whole of Rwanda rebuild. Mozambique. I actually think that Mozambique now is in a great position, and I know that they are doing many bilateral projects with Angola because their experience and their, you know, Lusophone culture is, and many of their you know, indigenous African cultures are so continuous that they're ideally placed to help. So that would be the main form of sort of, let's say, knowledge-based intervention that the international community could provide, and funding. I don't know enough about Angola to know whether the oil income is sufficient, you know, if it's correctly spread around to actually cover a lot of this. Mozambique, of course, has been an extremely poverty-stricken country throughout this whole period, and in the year 2001, suffered massive flooding. You know, so it's really dealt with and come through a lot. And I think the fact that they have done that, come through, you know, that lengthy period of poverty through those natural disasters and through three national elections, really speaks to the resilience of their process.
I know of at least three other hands in the air, like before. What I want to do is ask you to each state your question briefly, and then we'll give everyone on the panel a chance to respond to whichever questions they feel so moved to speak on. Yes, sir.
Thank you very much to all of you for your
presentation.
Yes, my name is Joseph Severente. I come from Rwanda, is to be in the government.
The speaker, actually. I speak Rwanda.
Now I live in the US. A few months ago, I spoke with my sister, who is also a survivor, and I asked her how the situation was in Rwanda, and especially about the Gacaca. And she told me that the relationships between Hutu and Tutsi were improving until Gacaca was introduced. Mm-hmm. So for her and for many people I speak with, they don't see Gacaca as something that would help in reconciliation. And that is the same feeling for many Hutu I speak with. So I wonder if Rwanda should maybe have chosen amnesty, at least to ordinary people who were involved in genocide, and focus on the leaders at all level who actually incited the people to go into genocide. I wonder if that would be the best solution. Another question is, I wonder, in a country like Rwanda, which is different from Mozambique, where the conflict ended through negotiations, or South Africa, where the conflict ended through negotiations. In Rwanda, it was one group winning over the other. And that one group, the Tutsi, it's a victim. They are victims. And they are those who are now in charge of justice. Can that be possibly fair?
Thank you very much. Very interesting.
Hi, I'm Diane Perlman. I'm a clinical and political psychologist, and I've written about this from the perspective of the trauma theory, death psychology, and I think what's good for requirements for individual healing are also good for the society, so I'll cut down.
Be very brief, because okay. We have lots more questions and we have about 6 minutes. So
okay. One is, I think you get a lot of healing from, I guess, truth, accurate recording of narrative and bearing witness, but also I emphasize apology rather than forgiveness, and maybe differentiate sort of the leaders of the perpetration from people who were caught up in it. And if people express, you know, remorse, retribution, or apology, then it's very easy to, I wouldn't pressure people to forgive when you have been told to injury, and you might design processes that support and encourage and train people to apologize, because that would promote a lot of healing.
My name is Eugenia Zorbeth. I'm a PhD student at the London School of Economics, and my thesis is on the reconciliation process in Rwanda. I'm hopefully approaching the end of it. In your discussion today, you broached, it's been really high caliber, you broached all of the problematic questions I've been trying to grapple with. And basically, my premise is that this field is still plagued with a lot of sloppy thinking, and you put your finger on a lot of it. You, for example, the sequencing justice versus peace, I think you made it clear that it's not necessarily mutually exclusive. Another one was just mentioned just now with the speaker about that there's an assumption that you need an intervention in order for things to get better. So, for example, in the Rwandan context, it was assumed that Gacaca. And it's another way in which sort of aspirational statements are conflated with factual statements with no real empirical research to back it up. Another one of the points that you haven't touched on yet today, but how could you? There's so many. Is one, actually, Neil Prince's book, I think you taught your three-volume Transitional Justice, is like pretty much the book that is considered a touchstone book. And in the very term transitional justice is another problem where you assume that reconciliation or transitional justice must occur in a democratizing or transitioning to a hopefully more democratic context. And I don't have in my PhD the basis to back that up. I think that that is another area that requires a lot more thought. For example, again, in the Rwandan context, I'm speculating, but would it be wise to preach for unbridled democracy in the Rwandan context today? I don't know.
Take this last question here. I'm Carla Winston, I'm Gerald Lucas. I'd just like to open up to all the panelists and Neil and play down the rest of it for a minute. What do you think are sources on what types of transitional justice mechanisms to use and their relative successes are based really on the nature of the political transition and also their just outright military victory and how that basically paid off once life settled, and then after this a very long assumption of peace and disposition to complete the organization of the government. I mean, how much swing in terms of reconciliation and peace and stability can you really expect from this mechanism?
Thank you. We've got more interesting issues on the table. I think I'm going to start at this end. Joyce, would you like to address any of those? Or all of them?
So many. I'm still thinking.
Shall I come back to Betty?
No, give me time to think.
That's our question.
Yeah.
By the time you have sent out, and we have used it.
Well, that's one strategy.
Joseph talked about the discussion with his sister about Gacaca and the likelihood that it may have aggravated relations between the Hutu and Tutsi instead of improving. I think the fact that the risk that Gacaca could aggravate the situation between the two communities was always there for those who cared to think about it in advance. In almost every community across Rwanda, most of the Tutsis were killed. The few survivors who remain on those hills are really very marginalized, powerless people who live in fear. Now you get them having to receive people who committed atrocities against them. And these people are supposed to come and be judged by their brothers, sisters, friends. How do you expect the people who are judging these cases to be fair? On one hand, you have to consider the interests of a marginalized, powerless person against the weight of their community and their friends and relatives. So the Gacaca is not something that can be, it has risks of being a threat to victims. This frustrates victims, and the more frustrated they become, the greater the antagonism between the two. So one cannot say the Gacaca leads to miscarriage of justice all the time, but it's potential to lead to a worsening of relations. Is very real. About whether the Gacaca or even the whole justice process in Rwanda can be fair to the perpetrators of the genocide. Again, that is a very important concern. What happened in Rwanda, there was, and again, it ties up with what Kala has just asked, the nature of the transition. What was the sequence? The sequence was, there was a war, the Tutsis were the victims, a Tutsi-dominated army won and set up a government. That army was itself responsible for some human rights abuses. So the Tutsi are in power, they are minority. They are afraid of being killed because the actual people are still committed to continuing the genocide. So they do not feel they can risk democracy because that could lead to their ultimate destruction. So as a minority, they have to write with all repression to stay in power and to survive. This does not obviously make the Hutu community happy. They regard justice as weak as justice, especially since the justice process addresses crimes of genocide but does not address human rights violations against the Hutu community. So justice actually is kind of a new field, a new source of conflict in Rwandan society. So it's not something that, it's not a, it's back to it's not bad to punish perpetrators of genocide, but the process is not a process that builds a historical record of what happened that helps to unite people. So there are a lot of people in the Hutu community who would rather frustrate the church as an expression of displeasure against the government because of all the concerns they have about it. So that there may be many Hutu in Rwanda who do not see the church as a fair process is right. To Kara's question, yes, the nature of the political transition has shaped how Rwanda has dealt with these issues. There was another question that I forgot, but what was it? The last but one. Would it be wise to preach?
You know, interestingly, now they seem better.
Why don't we turn, Ben, do you want to?
And
I want to
get
the
one of
the last words here.
Yeah, I want to. There's a conflict within myself. I'm thinking in the case of Uganda in respect to justice. Uganda is one country that has had a world of experience in wars. And with all these wars, the question of justice never arose. We had Idi Amin, who was estimated to have killed over 800,000 people over a period of time. When he left power, his cronies remained behind. Nobody talked about justice. Obote II came, and again, he was also accused of having killed close to 500,000 people, at least 200,000 people in the rural area. And a new government came in, nobody addressed the question of justice. It's all in there. And now you have, then there were subsequent governments, we say for Shatan and maybe the level of death did not rise so high. So where is this suddenly coming up from? So I'm bringing a different dimension to the debate. Whereas in the past, a new government came with its own army, put up a new government, nobody talked about retribution. And kind of people have had to cope. The only problem is what I see now is because we've managed to sit on all these problems, nobody's addressed them. So we very much point accusing fingers quietly at it is that tribe. Don't you know? And the children, the younger generation, are growing up with that feeling that, you know, these are the killers. This is what they did to us so many years ago. And one tribe is that conflict tension that continues because all these past problems have not been addressed. And now that the question of justice has become is the thing in conflict situations or post-conflict situations. I don't know what I'm saying. But basically, is it a Western concept or the fact that we've been able to move on somewhat with on our own life? And that this also applies to the Rwanda case, that in the Rwanda situation, I'm also thinking of the international community's guilt and therefore not trying to, even if they see danger, there's a problem in Rwanda, nobody wants to talk about it because they didn't do anything in 1994. Now, going back in the case of Uganda, there's potential for war to break out again because all these problems, it might take another 20 years, it might even take more than that. But because we've sat on with these problems, we know who did what and when, but we've not been able to address it. And therefore, it will be the younger generation, because these things are being moved down from one generation to the next. So, again, I just want to say that it's not purely a Western concept. It is something that it is a necessity to bring sustainable peace. And it's not just democracy that people are able to elect their own leaders. The question of justice needs to be addressed among all these other values that can bring sustainable peace.
Okay,
well,
we are already
7 minutes
over.
That's
what
I mean.
Okay.
What I wanted to address is what she asked for. Whether we can afford to preach and drive democracy in Rwanda. No, we cannot afford to. I think Rwanda must shape a system of government that protects minorities. But I also believe that minorities cannot rule majorities forever. They either have to find ways of resolving their differences, the majority peacefully, or they will be overthrown, and in fact, there could be another genocide in Rwanda if this does not happen. So what Rwanda needs to do is to maybe deal with their differences like what they've done in Burundi, around majority rule, but with a system that provides certain guarantees for the minority. Unless this happens, in my view, violence, even genocidal violence in Rwanda, is not just possible, but it's almost inevitable.
That's true. Yes. Very quickly, I'm sorry Diana just left, because I did want to note that we have not really talked about apology and apologizing. And I think that what has been found in much of the literature is that the need for apology remains in these cases for decades, if not generations. And so we are still waiting for an apology, I think, from the Japanese government, for example, for what happened during World War II with Korean comfort women. There are a number of apologies that are still being waited for, and this is not reparations. It's simply an act of acknowledgement, recognition, and of culpability. So I think apology is something that has great symbolic value. Secondly, on Gachacha and Mata Ofud, these local mechanisms, one thing I think we have to be very careful about is that they are manipulated. It's a word we've used, I think it's a good word, that they are very easily manipulated by the powers that be for purposes that may not have anything whatsoever to do with justice. I'm a little concerned about the push in Uganda for Mata Ofud, only because it occurs to me that perhaps the Ugandan government would be very pleased to see that happen so that no national television would be broadcasting the crimes that have also been committed by the military. And so so I think that one of the reasons that the government may have recently kind of glommed onto this idea of local mechanisms may be as a way to shield itself from a national airing of its dirty laundry.
Well, I just want to make one point, which is a big point in my book, big part of my argument, which is that the way atrocities are thought about and discussed in the Western discourse has, I think, become dominated by people with a sort of a technical legal approach to the issue and has become very apolitical and depoliticized. Whereas, actually, if you look at where atrocities are committed, they are committed in circumstances of war and large-scale intergroup conflict. Any society contains a small proportion, perhaps, of sociopaths. But usually, societies are able to identify and incapacitate these individuals, whether it's Jeffrey Dahmer or, you know, anybody that a society has some people like this. It's only in circumstances of war and large-scale intergroup conflict that these sociopaths become empowered. They multiply, they train up new people to work with them, they create networks. You know, so, yes, Neil describes Saddam Hussein as a monster, but I also describe him as somebody who is a creation of a situation of lengthy political conflict inside Iraq and wars that, you know, Iraq had with its neighbors. You know, under normal circumstances, as Saddam Hussein might have been, you know, and his sons definitely, would have been locked up in a mental institution a long time ago. But it is in the circumstance of war that this thing becomes the norm and becomes so widespread. So in order to stop atrocities, you have to stop the wars. And then, you know, then afterwards, after you've stopped the wars, you can deal with the longer-term healing things that need to occur. And so I guess what my book is a plea for is it's a plea to repoliticize this issue and to really understand the context in which, you know, these awful acts are committed and to really address the peacemaking necessity. And then once you've done that, you can, you know, sit around in the comfort of a conference room and discuss, you know, what is the context, content of justice. But, you know, if you don't even have... Like, you know, I was in the Nyama camp in near Gulu. There weren't even chairs, you know. They rustled around to try and find a chair for me to sit on. I was embarrassed. No, we sat under a tree and we discussed, you know. And so I guess that's what I want to... Let's get back to putting peacemaking back onto the agenda, and then we will really cut down the commission of atrocities hugely.
We need to stop the wars, and unfortunately, we need to stop this panel. I have a feeling we could go on all night. Thank you to our fascinating speaker and our very interesting discussions. I agree with our colleague from LSE that this is a very sophisticated discussion, and there's much more to be said, and I'm sure we'll be revisiting these issues